Krishna Prabhupada Mahamsa Parivaja Kachaya Asto Tadasada Shishimad, His Divine Grace, Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada Ki, ISKCON Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki, Ananti Gaudiya Vaishnavrinda Ki, Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki, Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki, Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nishananda Shivita Gadata Srila Sri Gaudiya Bhaktivedanta Ki, Shishi Radha Krishna Gopi Gopinath Shamakun Radhakun Giri Govardhan Ki, Shri Vrindavan Dham Ki, Shri Mayapur Dham Ki, Jagannath Puri Dham Ki, Ganga Maya Ki, Yamuna Maya Ki, Tulsi Devi Ki, Bhakti Devi Ki, Samaveda Bhakti Vrinda Ki, Go Premanandi, all glories the assembled devotees, all glories the assembled devotees, all glories the assembled devotees, all glories to Shri Shri Guru and Shri Gauranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. A reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 12, Dhruva Maharaj Goes Back to Godhead, Text 51. Jnanam agyata tatvaya yoda jat satpate mritam kripalo dinanatasya devastasya nugrinate jnanam agyata tatvaya Yoda jat satpate mritam Kripalo dinanatasya Devastasya nugrinate Jnanam agnyata tatvaya Yoda jat satpate mritam Kripalo dinanatasya Devastasya nugrinate Jnanam agnyata tatvaya Yoda jat satpate mritam Kripalo dinanatasya Devastasya nugrinate Jnanam agnyata tatvaya Yoda jat satpate mritam Kripalo dinanatasya Devastasya nugrinate
Yeah.
Jnanam, knowledge. Agyatatvaya, to those who are unaware of the truth. Ya, one who. Dajat, imparts. Sapate, on the path of truth. Amritam, immortality. Kripalo, kind. Dinanatasya, protector of the poor. Deva, the demigods. Tasya, to him. Anugrinate, give blessings. Translation: the narration of Dhruva Maharaj is sublime knowledge for the attainment of immortality. Persons unaware of the absolute truth can be led to the path of truth. Those who, out of transcendental kindness, take on the responsibility of becoming master protectors of the poor living entities, automatically gain the interest and blessings of the demigods. Please repeat. The narration of Dhruva Maharaj is sublime knowledge for the attainment of immortality. Persons unaware of the absolute truth can be led to the path of truth. Those who, out of transcendental kindness, take on the responsibility of becoming master protectors of the poor living entities, automatically gain the interest and blessings of the demigods. Purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Jnanam Agnyata means knowledge which is unknown, almost throughout the entire world. No one knows, actually, what is the absolute truth. Materialists are very proud of their advancement in education, in philosophical speculation, and in scientific knowledge. But no one actually knows what the absolute truth is. The great sage Maitreya, therefore, recommends that to enlighten people about the absolute truth, tattva, devotees should preach the teachings of Srimad Bhagavatam throughout the entire world. Srila Vyasadeva especially compiled this great literature of scientific knowledge because people are completely unaware of the absolute truth. In the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, it is said that Vyasadeva, the learned sage, compiled this great Bhagavat Purana just to stop the ignorance of the mass of people. Because people do not know the absolute truth, this Srimad Bhagavatam was specifically compiled by Vyasadeva under the instruction of Narada. Generally, even though people are interested in understanding the truth, they take to speculation and reach at most the conception of impersonal Brahman. But very few men actually know the personality of Godhead. Recitation of Srimad Bhagavatam is specifically meant to enlighten people about the absolute truth, the supreme personality of Godhead. Although there is no fundamental difference between impersonal Brahman, localized Paramatma, and the Supreme Person, factual immortality cannot be obtained unless and until one attains the stage of associating with the Supreme Person. Devotional service, which leads to the association of the Supreme Lord, is actual immortality. Pure devotees, out of compassion for the fallen souls, are kripalu, very kind to people in general. They distribute this Bhagavata knowledge all over the world. A kind-hearted devotee is called Dinanath, protector of the poor, ignorant mass of people. Lord Krishna is also known as Dinanath or Dinabandhu, the master or actual friend of the poor living entities, and his pure devotee also takes the same position of Dinanath. The Dinanaths, or devotees of Lord Krishna, who preach the path of devotional service, become the favorites of the demigods. Generally, people are interested in worshipping the demigods, especially Lord Shiva, in order to obtain material benefits. But a pure devotee who engages in preaching the principles of devotional service as prescribed in the Srimad Bhagavatam does not need to separately worship the demigods. The demigods are automatically pleased with him and offer all the blessings within their capacity. As by watering the root of the tree, the leaves and branches are automatically watered, so by executing pure devotional service to the Lord, the branches, twigs, and leaves of the Lord, known as the demigods, are automatically pleased with the devotee, and they offer all benedictions. Translation again. The narration of Dhruva Maharaj is sublime knowledge for the attainment of immortality. Persons unaware of the absolute truth can be led to the path of truth. Those who, out of transcendental kindness, take on the responsibility of becoming master protectors of the poor living entities automatically gain the interest and blessings of the demigods. Om Majanatam Randa Shaganam Janashalakaya Chakshur Invitamyana Tasmai Shri Guru Vinama Shri Chaitanya Manavishtam Stavitam Nibutale Swayal Bhagadamayam Vidati Swabadam Tikam Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Shivasari Gaura Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. I would just like to say a word or two, and actually by speaking I'm saying it, of appreciation for yesterday's class. I was sitting in the back there listening to it, and I found it a very wonderful class, so I just want to say thank you very much for that class, and that I hope that I can get the blessings of Nrisimha Maharaj to be able to say any kind of words that will be worthwhile today. Thank you, Maharaj. Hare Krishna. So, the story so far, as we say, and where we are now, Dhruva Maharaj going back to Godhead, of course it started with Dhruva being very hurt, I think maybe one of the best words to use, very hurt by his stepmother, Suruchi. And she effectively said, "You're not my son. You didn't come from my womb," which of course, as we understand, is very much the bodily kind of concept of life, materialistic view. And actually Prabhupada, I think of that during that part of the story, he makes the point that this is even happening in with the descendants of Swayambhuva Manu. This mentality and this kind of stuff going on. So she says basically that you're not my son, so you can't sit on the throne. It's even debatable as to whether he actually wanted to sit on the throne at that particular point in time. He was just wanting to sit on his father's lap, which any of you who are fathers in the room know is quite a natural thing for a son, particularly a daughter, to want to do. So anyway, you're not my son, you're not sitting on the throne. Go satisfy Lord Narayan by performing tapasya. Go satisfy Lord Narayan, and then maybe you can take birth in my womb. I think Prabhupada also mentions in that section how he refers to it in terms of a woman's nature, that it can be quite cruel like that. But I think in Kali Yuga, our understanding also from Shastra is that there's not so much distinction anymore between the male and the female of the species in many respects, particularly in relation to tendency to be harsh and to be cruel and to hurt people. It's kind of the material world is full of it. Completely full of it all the time. Yeah, so there's not much distinction, so although Prabhupada does make that reference, there's not so much distinction there. I know from traveling, many of you I'm sure travel quite a lot, and I know from traveling on probably most airlines, certainly certain airlines, that you can tell as soon as you get on from the male cabin crew that there's not much difference between male and females in the Kali Yuga anymore. I think it must be a prerequisite to get a job with the airlines, that if you're a male, to get a job with the airlines these days, to have the third gender, so to speak. Anyway, so there's not much difference there. Of course, Suniti, his mother, Dhruva's mother, her instruction was very profound to him, and she said that you shouldn't wish bad on others because it will come back on yourself. You shouldn't wish bad on others because it will come back on yourself. And of course, in essence, that's the basic principle of the law of karma. But it was a nice way of putting it, simply because for us to understand that we have to take responsibility for everything that happens to us is actually our own responsibility. We shouldn't look to others to blame or to point the finger at. Prabhupada, I was reading the other day in one little statement from Srila Prabhupada, and he was saying, I know myself from quote-unquote preaching in Western countries, people do have a problem accepting this point about that, you know, it's exclusively their responsibility, whatever happens to them. They really have a difficult, many, not everybody, but many people really kind of get stuck on that. They struggle. Of course, one reason they struggle is because they're not automatically identifying that this life is just one in their eternal existence, and they have a tendency to think this is the one life, so that makes it difficult. They can't really accept they've done something in a previous life to warrant what's happening now. But anyway, in this statement Prabhupada was saying, and he wasn't saying this to non-devotees, he was saying this to devotees, that your enjoyment or your suffering, and the word that he uses, is not the creation of God. Your enjoyment or suffering is not the creation of God. Your enjoyment and suffering, you are in the material world, which is a very contaminated place. And because it's so contaminated, it means that it's very difficult for us to not become contaminated as a result of being in the material world. So we must be very, very cautious, very, very cautious to avoid becoming contaminated. If we're not cautious and we allow ourselves to become contaminated, then we will suffer. Then we will suffer as a result. So Suniti was instructing Dhruva Maharaj in this way, that don't wish bad on others. Don't do that. And if the only reason not to do that, not simply because it's not a nice thing to do, if the only inspiration for you not to do that is that it will simply come back on you, so why do it? Because whatever you're wishing on others, we have that phrase in English, be careful what you wish for, that whatever we wish on others will actually come back on us. So Prabhupada's explaining in that part of the story, how cruel the material energy is, and then if we're contaminated by the material energy, how potentially cruel we can be as a result of that. Because in this case, here you have a stepmother, you know, who's like the wife of King Uttanapad, and Dhruva's just a five-year-old boy, and she basically crushes him. We have that phrase in English that you crush somebody, you know, with harsh words. Also earlier in this part of the Bhagavatam, we're talking about the birth of all these different qualities, and one of the qualities that Prabhupada refers to as being born, or the Bhagavatam is referring to, is the quality of harsh speech like that. And you know, you can literally crush people for many, many years by harsh words, saying something cruel and nasty to them. So Suniti is giving Dhruva very, very good advice like that. And then we know that Dhruva, it affected him so much that he wanted to go, and as we know, he wanted something even superior to what his father had, and superior to anybody else had in the universe. And even though Narada Muni instructed him kind of differently initially, Dhruva said that he didn't think he could surrender to that, or at least he was saying that this is what he really wants. So then Narada gave him the instructions that he gave him. And because, even though in one sense the motivation in the beginning, we understand the motivation in the beginning wasn't perfect, that because he followed the instructions of Narada Muni, his spiritual master, he followed those instructions, that eventually he achieved perfection like that. And of course, Bhagavad Gita tells us that chatur vidya bhajanti mam, that there are four kinds of persons who surrender to or come to Krishna consciousness. The distressed, the desire of wealth, the inquisitive, and those searching after the absolute truth. And in the purport to that particular verse, Prabhupada explains that it actually doesn't matter how you come to Krishna consciousness, because the can, again, from a material calculation, we can kind of calculate, or at least my mind calculates, that if someone is coming to Krishna consciousness because they're searching after the absolute truth, that from a material calculation, that seems like a purer or a better motivation than somebody coming to Krishna consciousness because they want to become wealthy. It just seems like that. But Prabhupada explains in the purport that it actually makes no difference once one takes to the process of Krishna consciousness, that you know, they can achieve perfection like that. So in the ultimate issue, it makes no difference. So unlike Suruchi and her very harsh words and her kind of style, and also in that point about surrendering to Krishna and taking to the process of Krishna consciousness, Devahuti, in her first question to her son Kapila, her very first question to her son was Nivina Nitaram Bhumam Asadindriya Tarshanat. She's explaining that Asadindriya, so the temporary association, Asad, the temporary association of the senses, like that, engaging like that, is bringing misery to her, is bringing misery. But in the actual translation, and also Prabhupada elaborates in the purport, that Devahuti is expressing that she's tired of this. She's tired of this suffering that's coming from the engaging the senses in material sense gratification. And Prabhupada really highlights this point, that for us to actually make advancement in Krishna consciousness, for us to actually go somewhere in Krishna consciousness, we actually have to become tired of that. We have to become fed up with it. We have to get to the point where we spit at the thought of that. Otherwise, it becomes very, very difficult to make advancement in Krishna consciousness, because we're in a very classical sense, we're having one foot in both camps, so to speak, the spiritual camp and the material camp. And if we're not pulling that foot out of the material camp, then ultimately it's going to win us over, the foot in the spiritual camp is going to become the thing that we're tired of, and the thing that's kind of annoying us and irritating us and sort of whatever like that. So anyway, Devahuti's very first question to Lord Kapila was that question, and expressing that she's tired of sense gratification like that. Prabhupada explains that that's what we have to do. We have to follow in her footsteps and also become tired, jaded, fed up with material sense gratification. Okay, so now in the purport today, a few things that caught my attention immediately here were, no one knows what is the absolute truth. I think as devotees, that's something that we can see very clearly. But then the message is here that the great sage Maitreya, therefore, recommends that to enlighten people about the absolute truth, tattva, devotees should preach the teachings of Srimad Bhagavatam throughout the entire world. Now, of course, we have Srila Prabhupada, who is the Senapati Bhakta, who actually, did this. He actually went throughout the world to spread this message of Srimad Bhagavatam. And he in the purport, it starts talking about devotees being Dinanath and compassionate and very compassionate towards the ignorant mass of people and the fallen souls like that. And it also talks about achieving immortality. And my understanding is that, because there's a big discussion about immortality in all the different stages, but in essence for us as Prabhupada Nugas, the best way that we can achieve that is by following in his footsteps and by becoming para upakara and preaching this message preaching this message of Srimad Bhagavatam throughout the entire world. And you know, we can give many examples of how Prabhupada, just the simple fact that he left India at 69, left Vrindavan at 69 years of age to go to the West, like what an incredible endeavor. I'm 20 years younger than that now, I'm 49 years of age, and I know when I get up off the seat here, off the Vyasasan today, my left knee in particular will take at least, you know, 3-5 minutes to sort of go back to normality, so I'll be able to walk properly. It's just the way it is. I'm 49, you know. Srila Prabhupada was 69 when he actually left to go to a place he'd never been before on a 6-week boat journey. We take a nine-hour flight, and we're complaining about it the whole time, you know. And oh, I'm jet lag. You know, you arrive in Mayapur, you know, no one sees you for a week. Oh, jet lag, bro. You know, it's like, you know, a 9-hour flight. So just that example of Prabhupada is just absolutely incredible if we analyze it and study it. But I was reading a couple of weeks ago, maybe even more now, you know, but it just stuck with me. I had read it before. You know, when you read something sometimes and for whatever reason you just read it and it just passes you by, and another time you read it and it's sort of like bang, you know, it sort of hits you like a ton of bricks. So I was reading a little while back this exchange that Prabhupada had with Hari Kesh Swami at the time. And Hari Kesh, apparently, maybe there was someone before him, because I'd heard that Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj maybe also. But anyway, at least in this exchange, or this little excerpt that I read, it was Hari Kesh, that he was the first devotee that Prabhupada sent behind the Iron Curtain. And in those days, it really was an Iron Curtain. Now, of course, we can go to Eastern Europe and Russia, and it's not a problem. You know, the Iron Curtain's gone. But in those days, it was the Iron Curtain, you know, and you had all these dictators like Ceausescu and Honecker and all these different guys, that if you look the wrong way, you'd get shot kind of thing, you know? Like, it was an extremely harsh and strong regime. So Hari Kesh was the first person to apparently go. And he was there for a period of time. I'm not sure exactly how long it was. And then he came back. And I think it was actually in India that this conversation with Prabhupada took place, but I'm not 100% sure. But it was the first time that Prabhupada had seen him after he was aware that Hari Kesh had, he had sent Hari Kesh, and Hari Kesh had gone behind the Iron Curtain to Eastern Europe, etc. So when he saw Hari Kesh, the first thing he said to him was, "Ah, how's the preaching going, you know, in the Eastern Bloc countries?" And Hari Kesh, my apologies to you, took the opportunity to whinge. He had a good moan. He started off having a good moan, actually, you know, and he said to Prabhupada, he said, "Ah, Prabhupada, you know, it's like, whatever about opening a temple, whatever about distributing a book, you know, whatever about, you know, doing a Harinam." He says, "Prabhupada, you can't even eat there. When you want to eat, you can't even get fresh vegetables." And Prabhupada said in a very, you know, low-key, you know, insubstantial way, he just said, "Oh, then you can take meat." So Hari Kesh looks at the other person in the room, which might have been Hari Suri, I'm a little sketchy on the details, might have been Hari Suri. He looks at him for verification. Did you hear what I thought I heard Prabhupada say? And if it's Hari, whoever it was, sort of looks at Hari Kesh as if to say, "Well, maybe, not really sure." So Hari Kesh repeats the same words again. "Yes, Prabhupada, like, it's really difficult even to get fresh vegetables." And this time Prabhupada cuts him off and in a much stronger, firmer voice says, "Then you can take meat." You know? And then Hari Kesh looks at Hari Suri, whoever it is, and Prabhupada definitely did say that. So then Hari Kesh, after a few seconds, I don't know, 10, 20 seconds, gathers his thoughts. Then he says to Prabhupada, he says, "But Prabhupada, what about my consciousness?" And Prabhupada says, "Damn your consciousness, the preaching must go on." Now that is just an extraordinary, for me, that is an absolutely extraordinary exchange. Because we know that every single person who took initiation from Prabhupada, and every single person who takes initiation within the Hare Krishna movement, vows to chant 16 rounds a day and to follow the four rules. And the first one that we repeat is no meat, no fish, no eggs, or any of their derivatives. Because it's a really fundamental aspect of practicing Krishna or practicing spiritual life is to develop compassion. If we don't develop compassion for other living entities, first off, we're not going to preach, that's the first thing, but we're not going to be able to develop in our own Krishna conscious life if we don't develop compassion. So this is an extraordinary statement from Prabhupada, you know, damn your consciousness, the preaching must go on. So what for me at least is the real key message that you get from that exchange with Harikesh is that spreading this message of Krishna consciousness is like it supersedes everything else. It doesn't. Prabhupada's not suggesting that it's okay to eat meat. He's not suggesting anything of the sort, but he's giving a clear message, you know. We don't think about ourselves. That's not the issue. Our consciousness is not the issue. We simply have to spread this message of Krishna consciousness, and we have to do whatever it takes in order to spread that message. So yeah, so that was a very, very powerful powerful thing. And why? Why is Prabhupada and all the acharyas so strong on this point? Why? Because people are in illusion, and because they're in an illusion, they're suffering, and they're just going to suffer more and more and more and more and more. And here we have devotees of Dinanath and their Dina Bandhu, and the whole idea is they want to terminate the suffering of all living entities, and the way to do that is introduce them to Krishna consciousness and give them the opportunity to engage in Krishna consciousness. So where does that lead us? Where does that illusion lead us if it's not checked? If that illusion is not checked, and if devotees are not taking people, literally taking people out of the illusion of the material world. It also in the purport it talks about the materialists are very proud of their advancement in education, in philosophical speculation, and in scientific knowledge. So they're very proud of this, and of course Prabhupada, again, one of his favorite pastimes was challenging the scientific view of the world, which gets worse and worse actually. It just, as time goes on, it gets worse and worse, and it seems that no matter how many times, you know, there's evidence to the contrary, the scientists will always come up with a way to still, you know, circumvent that and present their materialistic philosophy. I read a book recently by a devotee, and he was explaining how this whole thing about the missing link, and from, I'm not a great scientific personality, brain, but the whole thing about the Big Bang, and then there was amoebas, and the amoebas developed into bigger amoebas, and the bigger amoebas developed into bigger amoebas, and then the biggest amoebas developed into little tadpoles or something, and then the tadpoles and blah 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 blah, and then you get human beings, you know. So you go from these the Big Bang and little amoebas to human beings, you know. So then if you follow the line in between, all the way in between, you get to this thing where they say, because obviously logic would say that if we all started from that and now we have human beings, therefore we have everything in between. I mean, that's just a simple, simple logical for anyone with half a brain, you know, that we have the whole spectrum now, therefore we have everything that's in between. So when you go along the line, you come to this thing where there's something actually missing. You have the monkeys and the apes and all of those creatures, and you have the human beings. So where's the thing in between? And of course they refer to that as the missing link. That's what they refer to it as. So this devotee is explaining that they come up with all this complicated stuff to actually explain that, how the fossils and all the different things happen. And it's very, very complicated. But relatively recently in the scientific world, some decades ago, someone came up with a challenge to that actual theory, that even if you study all the fossils, you will see why the missing link makes sense, etc., etc. And they found that actually there's this massive gap between certain fossils and then suddenly fossils that represent the missing link, or whatever way it works exactly. So I nearly forgot, because these things, the word jugglery is so incredible, you know, it's so incredible. So what they came up with, they said, but this is punctuated equilibrium. And when you hear that, if you're not a scientific person, if you hadn't studied these things, you know, the tendency is, just like Suruchi was very harsh with Dhruva, of course, Dhruva was a real kshatriya, so he didn't take it lying down. But still, you get hurt. So when somebody with so-called a big, big brain just goes, yes, that's punctuated equilibrium. And then they go on to explain, you know, in a convoluted way what punctuated equilibrium. A lot of people will just sort of think, punctuated equilibrium, you know, wow, yeah, yeah, wow. Yeah, that's what it is, yeah, what silly me. Yes, you know, punctuated equilibrium. Why didn't I think of that, you know? It's also like the recession that we had when it started 3 years ago. And, you know, they came up with this thing that the solution to the recession is quantitative easing. I don't know if you ever heard that phrase. Quantitative easing. And everyone goes, I feel better now. We've discovered quantitative easing. Now the problems will all go away. And then, of course, when people start to prod and analyze and ask, well, what actually is quantitative easing? It turns out they're just printing money. That's a really good solution. Please give me some of it. But anyway, so punctuated equilibrium. So this is what they're doing. And why are they doing it? It's quite interesting, actually. They come up with all these theories and all these things. Why are they doing it? They're doing it because they've got this incredible attachment. Of course, we know it, in one sense it's deeper than this. But they've got this incredible attachment to proving, to actually proving that we came from monkeys. It's kind of an interesting thing, you know, that they're so attached to prove that we came from monkeys that they'll come up with absolutely anything. And of course, Prabhupada says, but we know better. If we go to Vrindavan, we see monkeys. Simply nonsense, you know. Why would you want to come from monkeys like that? So, this is why we have to... The illusion is so, so big. And I may have given this example before, but I just think it's a fantastic example. That in the West, at least, not so much in India, I don't think, but in the West, the illusion... We're in this massive illusion, you know, that we think that we're the material body. And here we have example of you know, descendants of Swayambhuva Manu, who are, you know, also in that sense, in the same illusion like that. So this is a really, really big illusion that we're in, this material world. But on top of that, then we like to create other illusions. So what do? In the West, they've created this illusion of Santa Claus or Father Christmas. They've created that illusion. And up until the age of 10, depending on how bright you are, or maybe how much you like the illusion, one or the other. But up to the age of 10, 11, I'm not sure exactly, I can't really remember what age I was. But you know, you fully embrace this illusion. Probably got something to do with the fact that you get these presents every year, but still, you know, you fully embrace it. And they actually, it's got bigger now. They're really developing the illusion, you know. At one point it was just once a year, you know, the guy comes down your chimney and leaves you, you know, a present. Now, you know, 2 weeks, 4 weeks before Christmas, you know, you've got chartered airplanes flying over to northern Finland, you know, to Lapland. And over there they've got this incredible world, you know, in the snow and the ice. You know, they've got Santa's village with all his elves living in it. And you go up there, when the airplane lands, you know, when you step down off the airplane, you don't get into a bus or a taxi or whatever. You're not in the airport. You get into a sledge, and it's driven by a guy in an elf suit, you know, with reindeer, and he, you know, cracks the whip, and the reindeer head off through Santa's village, you know, and all the elf houses or huts, wooden log huts and all that, and then you come to Santa's mansion at the top of the hill, you know, and you go up to Santa's, and then you go in, and Santa's there, and you go. And, you know, the kids are just being filled with this illusion like that. And, of course, the parents are doing it. They pay the £1,000 or whatever it costs to bring the kids to the place. To imbibe this illusion deeper and deeper. And, of course, what are they doing? They're actually enjoying. They're enjoying the illusion through their children. And then just like here with Suruchi, because at least Suruchi was being direct in that sense. This is indirect. When you reach 10 or 11 or 9 or whatever age it is that you reach, suddenly that you realize it, and then it's really hurtful because there's always an older kid in school who tells you, and says, don't tell me you believe in Santa, you wimp, you know, and it's like, of course I don't believe in Santa, you know, and you put on this kind of brave face, and then all the way home from school that day, You're just in shock. You're in trauma. You know, you need counselling. You're only 9 years of age, and you need to go to a counsellor. You know, to extract you from the illusion of believing in Santa Claus for the last 9 years like that. So they supposedly do it to help you, to be nice to you, but it's just so crushing and so cruel. That's actually what it is. And that's the material world, whether it's done deliberately, whether it's done indirectly, it just every time, bang, 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 whether it's on a psychological level, a physical level, you know, whatever level it's on, you just get crushed and smashed again and again. Hence, Nivina Nitalam Bhumam Asadindriya Tarshana, that Devahuti is saying, you know, I'm tired of this, I'm exhausted of this. So, you know, for us, you know, just before I go on to that, I just want to, I don't know the time here now, I just want to go on to the fact that, so we should have that motivation for ourselves personally, to be tired of the material energy, but also, in order to please Srila Prabhupada, in order to please the previous acharyas, we can only be effective in spreading the message of Lord Chaitanya if we're actually tired of that. Otherwise we cannot be effective in spreading that message. And actually it's something we really need to look at. In the material world, we all have to take responsibility for our lives. Whatever situation we're in within the Varna and Ashram institution, whatever the situation is, just like we're told in the Bhagavatam, that a king or an executive head has no right to levy taxes. No right to levy taxes unless they protect the people. If they're levying taxes and not protecting the people, then they're in for some super heavy karma as a result. So all of us, wherever we're situated in our particular Varna Ashram situation in life, we all have responsibility. If we're a Grihastha, we have a responsibility. If we're the male of the version, now I'm making a distinction between the male and the female, if we're the male of the version, we have a responsibility to protect our wife. If we're the female of the version, we have a responsibility to remain faithful to our husband. Both versions, male and female, have a responsibility to protect their children, educate their children, and bring them up as best as they can in a Krishna conscious lifestyle. So every single, whatever role we're playing in the world at the moment, we have responsibility. And if we don't take that responsibility seriously, then we can't push on this movement. We can't do it. If anybody picks up one of Srila Prabhupada's books, I don't want to get on a pedestal here or a hobby horse, but it's come into my brain now while I'm speaking, so now I'm going to continue the theme. But if we pick up any of Srila Prabhupada's books, you will see, you know, at least every chapter, you know, or less or whatever, you will see where he says that, you know, the institution of marriage is very, very important, and without it, we've an animalistic society. I mean, that's what I read Prabhupada saying all the time. So as devotees, how can we justify not upholding that institution properly? And how the hell do we think that we're going to go out and be able to tell people to become devotees and to follow us if we give them a book and they read that and then they ask us, what's your situation? Well, I'm on my 15th wife, you know, but I'm looking forward to my 16th because my 15th is a real case. Or vice versa, whatever the situation may be. So, you know, we're here in Sridhar Mayapur. It's the spiritual world. But we're not meant to hog this for ourselves. That's not what it's all about. We're not meant to be keeping this all to ourselves. We're meant to be giving this, making this available to as many people as possible. But those people will only take us seriously if we're taking the Krishna conscious process seriously, if we're taking the holy dham seriously, etc., etc. We can only expect to be taken seriously to the degree that we're taking things seriously. And why it's so important? Because people are suffering. That's a simple thing. Why did we come to Krishna consciousness? I know those four categories, Chaturvidya, Vajantimam, that whether it's the distressed, the seeker of wealth, the inquisitive, and the person seeking the absolute truth. I know for myself, I think I was at least 90% in the distressed category. That was my category. But I think practically every devotee will tell you there was at least an element of distress to their reason for taking to Krishna consciousness like that. You know? So we were given this opportunity by whoever gave you the book or whoever, you know, you met on the street or whoever whatever the situation was. We were given this opportunity like that. And if you remember, I can remember the devotee who preached to me about Krishna consciousness, I can remember, he was like a hero. You know, he was just like, you know, and I still do hold him in great reverence. But he was like, when he was speaking to me, he was like a hero. I remember I did a school program with this person, it was more than a year ago, in a school, in a secondary school in Dublin. Students are about 17, 18 years of age, they're leaving that year. And their teacher, the religious teacher, he had been a priest. But now he was a layperson. And of course I didn't know that at the time, he told me that afterwards. And I went there with, you know, about four or five devotees, and we had kirtan and gave some prasadam and made a short presentation of Krishna consciousness. And after it, he came up to me and he said, "Pragosh, I never knew. I never knew." And I says, "You never knew what?" And he says, "I never knew that you Hare Krishnas had all this incredible information and knowledge. I never knew it. I only knew you from wearing strange clothes and chanting on the streets. This is just revelationary to me, what you've just spoken for the last 25 minutes or whatever it was." He says, "This is just incredible." And you could see he was visibly just awestruck with the information that we had presented. So that awestruck, that reverence that he's holding the devotee in, think how undermined that will be if he then realizes that you're just talking, you're not actually doing. You know, think how undermined that will be like that. So it's a huge responsibility on us, and the illusion. So where does that illusion lead? From the innocent child going to see Santa in Santa's castle or Santa's thing, where does the illusion ultimately lead? It ultimately leads in us thinking, or us wanting rather, thinking maybe and wanting to be the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's where it actually leads. And if we just reflect on the pastime of Lord Nrsimhadeva and Hiranyakashipu, just for one moment, a real quick thing. At the point when Lord Nrsimhadeva burst from the pillar, and as we have down here, you know, in our temple here in Mayapur, we have Ugra Nrsimha, and as I read from the Nrsimhadeva book that Pankajanri Prabhu wrote, that it's Ugra Stanhu Nrsimha. It's the most fearsome form of Lord Nrsimhadeva that exists. There's nine forms of Lord Nrsimhadeva, and it's the most fearsome form of Lord Nrsimhadeva. And he is bursting out of that pillar. His eyes are like blazing suns. You know, his teeth are like whatever they're described to be, like razor blades or whatever it is. His nails, his claws are primed right in the face of Hiranyakashipu like that. He's on what we call his hunkers. He has better knees than me. And he's just ready to pounce. And if we look at the picture, the BBT picture, Hiranyakashipu looks about maybe 20% the size, or maybe 25% the size of Lord Nrsimhadeva. But that may also not even be in scale, because I know Prahlad and Lord Nrsimhadeva is 20 times difference, I read in that book. So here he is, you know, the most fearsome form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, massive in size compared to little Hiranyakashipu, you know. And right at that point, and we know what happens next, you know, next picture, all his entrails just out all over the place. That's the next picture. So we're just seconds away from this event. What does Hiranyakashipu say? He says, "Prayena meyam harinoru mayena." Prayena meyam harinoru mayena. And if we translate that into colloquial British-Irish English, if we just translate that into colloquial English, what he says to Lord Nrsimhadeva at that very point in time is, "Come on, bring it on, I'm ready for you." That's what he's saying, you know. 2 seconds later, dead, entrails all over the place, end of. But that's what he's saying. And that's where the illusion leads. That's where the illusion leads for all of us. So if that isn't instruction enough for us, if that's not substantial enough for us to do two things. One, to really be humble and get our own trip together, you know, to protect ourselves from that conclusion. And secondly then, to want to have an inspiration and to understand why Srila Prabhupada went out at 69 years of age to protect everybody else from that conclusion. And why he even said to Hari Kesh, when he couldn't find vegetables in East Berlin, Take meat then, but the preaching must go on. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki. Yeah, maybe I'll take one question because I think I should finish at 9, but Prabhupada asked for.
Yeah, I don't want to be taken the wrong way. I'm not in any way questioning or criticizing Srila Prabhupada's amazing focus. And that was such a heavy statement where not only the idea, as you explained that, and you said, you take meat, you explain for our benefit that Prabhupada was not condoning meat eating, but rather he said it to dramatize the essential importance and the urgency of the preaching. So that part was okay. But then I had a little difficulty hearing that Srila Prabhupada said, damn your consciousness. Now, the idea is the preaching is so important. Now, so the saying is that hindsight is always 20/20 vision. In other words, when you look at things from the future back into the past, then you always have a much better vision of what's going on. So we don't want to get into individual cases, but you did mention the name of this devotee, and it's a very, very, he did tremendous, tremendous service in our movement. But then there was also a tremendously negative impact when he had his very, very serious fall down. So, shouldn't we be a little bit cautious as the way we understand this, that we shouldn't misunderstand this idea of damn your consciousness? We also hear the expression, doctor, heal thyself. In other words, he did such great work in the preaching, but then because his own consciousness, not because he ate meat, but his own consciousness for whatever reason had degraded, then there was almost a worldwide impact in our movement. Of course, he wasn't the only one, but his case was extremely intense, and I personally dealt with some of his disciples, and it was a very, very extremely painful thing. So the preaching was there, but then you might say the anti-preaching was also there. So again, I'm not trying to criticize Prabhupada's statement, but at the same time, maybe you could clarify this a little bit and say something like
that. Yeah, I mean, whenever you speak, you know, depending on, because the purport was very much expressing the point about preaching Srimad Bhagavatam throughout the entire world and devotees are dinanath, etc. like that. So, you know, so that leads you to present in a certain way. You could turn the page and read another purport where Prabhupada is stressing, you know, the process of sadhana bhakti and how important that is. So it's really a question of, you know, the purport that you receive and like that. But of course, all of these things are relevant in the sense they're all pastimes of Prabhupada and they're all instructions of Prabhupada. But I would just underscore what Prabhupada Dasguru was saying, that, you know, it doesn't mean that we can go out and eat meat, you know, I'm out in Sankirtan one day, I'm a bit peckish, I'll go in and have a Big Mac, you know. Doesn't mean that, and, you know, please understand that is not what it means, you know. But it is emphasizing two things. One is the importance of preaching. It has to continue, no matter what situation. And we know devotees will say, even if I have to go to hell, as long as I can serve Krishna. The second thing is emphasizing is we shouldn't be selfish. Because Hari K says, what about my consciousness? You know. So Prabhupada is also picking up on that, the kind of potential selfish thing. I should stress also, I don't think it's connected in any way, shape or form with what happened later with that Prabhu. But even on that point, I will say, and I hope I'm not controversial in saying this, but, you know, Tamal Krishna Maharaj did go to Prabhupada one time. He told me this personally. I'm not sure if it's recorded anywhere. It may well be recorded. But he went to Prabhupada one time, and he expressed concern about the number of devotees that seemed to be having trouble in their Krishna consciousness and leaving. And Prabhupada's response was, we are engaged in a war on Maya, and in a war there will be casualties. But my understanding is, just as in the material analogy, that, you know, casualties of war are heroes, and they're remembered, and they're seen as heroes. And in the same way, if devotees struggle after doing such wonderful service, you know, we know that there's no loss of diminution. And you know, ultimately they will be glorious like that. But it is a very important point, because Harry Case, I said at the beginning when I said that story, he took the opportunity to kind of complain. When Prabhupada asked him, how's it going? He started to kind of complain. So it was probably a bad foot to get off on, you know. It's kind of like, you know what it's like. If you ask somebody something, they start whinging. You know, it's a little more of a challenge for you to be really favorably disposed towards them. Oh God, he's whinging again. You know? So that was probably a mistake. But I also was reading from Prabhupada the other day, where he was saying, Krishna is joyful. This goes back to us having being effective preachers, actually. He says, Krishna is joyful. Therefore, we're joyful. If my father is black, I will be black. If my father is white, I will be white. Krishna is joyful. Therefore, we're joyful. Krishna didn't work in a factory. Krishna didn't work with heavy machinery. Krishna simply plays his flute in the association of Radha, the gopis and the gopas and whatever else. Krishna is joyful. Therefore, we're joyful. If we're not joyful, we're doing something wrong in Krishna consciousness. So if we're always going to this counselor, that counselor, this therapist, that therapist, you know, if we're waking up thinking, oh no, it's the biorhythms today, I have to sleep an extra 16 hours, or, you know, whatever it is, you know, there's some disconnect between Susukam Karta Mavyayam and some disconnect between us and Krishna, because Krishna is joyful, therefore Prabhupada says, we're joyful. Thank you, Prabhupada Swaroop. I'll take one last question from Gita Nagri Guru, because he had his hand up. Thank you. Microphone.
Yeah, by some miracle I was reading Prabhupada's Harisari's Transcendental Diary.
And that's actually, where it is, right?
It's in I read that pastime yesterday. But in the conversation with, in that conversation, a little, couple pages before where he actually says that, Prabhupada was talking about how when he went to New York City, he had to put his food in a refrigerator, especially when he was staying with
Sally Carl. Agarwal.
Yeah, no, not Sally. Yes.
Yeah, oh no, yeah, Dr. Mishra.
Carl.
Oh yeah.
Carl
yeah.
And Carl. His, yeah, and, yeah, his, yeah. And his girlfriend. So you know, when he was in that apartment for two weeks, he had to put his food into a refrigerator right next to the meat. So. You know, this is unheard of, you know, for Prabhupada, and considering the culture he comes from and everything like that. So that was also part of that conversation, you know, somehow or other, a couple pages before that.
Yeah, the Karmis have a saying, non-devotees have a saying, you know, the things we do for love. So I suppose the devotees could have a saying, you know, the things we do for preaching or whatever. Because in that same pastime, Prabhupada in New York City, you know, he's walking the two blocks to get his supplies in the January or December, January in New York. And with the wind chill, when you take the wind chill into account, it's minus 30 degrees. You know, Prabhupada's come from Vrindavan, you know, and he's wearing his sannyas cloth, you know, minus 30 degrees. Goes back, when he's in Dr. Misha's ashram, goes back, someone's broken into his room and stolen his dictaphone, and whatever, a typewriter, whatever else. Like, I mean, it's like the inconveniences that Prabhupada put up. And if he hadn't have put up with those, this is the amazing thing, if he hadn't have put up with those inconveniences, it's almost certain that not one single one of us would be here today, sitting here now today. Not one of us, if Prabhupada hadn't have done that. So, yeah, it's not that Prabhupada's saying we can eat meat. Of course not. It's crazy. And any devotee that would remotely extract that from that conversation, really, really, you need to go to a therapist. But, you know, you need to do something. Because that's not the message. The message is, you know, everyone's suffering out there. We got to do absolutely everything in our power to get them. And that's another point. Not to shout at them and tell them how fallen they are and tell them their cases. Somehow, whatever it takes to get them attracted to the process of Krishna consciousness, you know, so they can become joyful like us. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.